What's the difference between DIY and doing it yourself? It's the difference between a part-time passion and a full-time business. Wix gives you the power to turn your passion into a moneymaker. With a website that fits your unique vision, let your ideas flow with AI that guides you, but keeps you in the driver's seat. Manage your business from one dashboard and keep it growing with built-in marketing features. It's time to turn your daydream into your dream job. Go to Wix.com. It's time to turn your daydream into your dream job. Wix gives you the power to turn your passion into a moneymaker with a website that fits your unique vision and drives you towards your goals. Let your ideas flow with AI tools that guide you, but give you full control and flexibility. Manage your business from one dashboard and keep it growing with built-in marketing features. Get everything you need to turn your part-time passion into a full-time business. Go to Wix.com. What's the difference between DIY and doing it yourself? It's the difference between a part-time passion and a full-time business. Wix gives you the power to turn your passion into a moneymaker. With a website that fits your unique vision, let your ideas flow with AI that guides you, but keeps you in the driver's seat. Manage your business from one dashboard and keep it growing with built-in marketing features. It's time to turn your daydream into your dream job. Go to Wix.com. You set the gold standard for your business. Your website should do the same. Wix puts you at the helm so you can enjoy the creative freedom of designing your site just the way you want. Want someone to bounce your ideas off? Talk with AI to create a beautiful site together. Whatever your business, manage it from one place and tie it all together with a personalized domain name. Gear up for success with a brand that says you best. You can do it yourself on Wix.
Because in the end, it's not who you know, it's who you can't trust. You're listening to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Here we are, the trial of Richard Allen for the Delphi murders. It is going on right now as of our recording, wrapping up day four. We're going to talk about what took place today in the courtroom, but since it's our first time now checking with Bob Mata, who's been in the courtroom day by day from the podcast Defense Diaries, it's going to be very interesting now to hear your perspective. I have many questions as I've been watching this and I've been listening to your coverage on Defense Diaries. You and your wife Allie doing some great coverage and really interesting commentary on what you guys have observed in that courtroom. Please do go check that out if you're onto this case. But before we talk about today and before we talk about even like the trial itself, I want to get your take. What's it feeling like in there? And what are we seeing? What are our characters, in this story, in this real life drama? What are we seeing in there?
So I think first and foremost, kind of the first thing I noticed, more so when the trial started in earnest as opposed to like jury selection, but like when we went in for opening statements, that Rick Allen seemed to be all there to me. Like, he was very talkative with his lawyers. His eyes looked normal. He didn't have that 1,000-yard stare like he's on tramadol,
yeah,
or some kind of tranquilizer. He seemed really, really in the moment. None of the weird staring up at the ceiling like he's, got deprivation. He just seems very intact.
Okay.
Which is important. Mm-hmm. It's important for the process. It's like, no matter what the outcome is, I want it to be fair, and I want that guy to be sitting there having an idea of what's going on around him. Mm-hmm. And I get the sense that he does.
Okay.
So as far as Carroll County, it's small. Man, I can't stress enough. This is a very small courthouse. Seats are at a premium. I was fortunate enough to get a reserve seat, which has caused some consternation from some fellow podcasters. Which, Tony, I'm not going to lie, I don't care.
I don't either.
But in all honesty, I feel terrible. Like, the line situation is draconian. Yeah. Like these folks are having to, they're getting out there and they keep making the mistake of telling each other when they're going out there, which just causes the other people to go out there in front of them, which just keeps pushing the time earlier and earlier.
Yeah.
Allie and I keep telling them like, that is not pro moves. Like you just keep your shit to yourself and you quietly slip out there. But the worst part of it, frankly, is that on a daily basis, at least in the first few days, that the people that did wait online to get in and do get in, that when they take the lunch break, they clear the courtroom. Mm-hmm. And once the courtroom is cleared, the line has to restart right outside of the courthouse, or actually they've been doing it right outside of the courtroom, which means that they're not able to go to lunch.
Yeah.
Because they have to reline up. It's brutal. I don't know why they're just not handed a number. And just say if they've spent the night, they've earned that space for the entire day.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned.
Sure.
But who are you going to complain to?
Yeah.
Like that's going to fall. Right. She ain't feeling it, but, state's prepared. Defense is prepared. You know, I'm not getting any sense that either side is in there bumbling and stumbling. Mm-hmm. Case is going to put on, the state's going to put on what their case is, you know, and that's good, bad, or indifferent. And the same with the defense. And they're up to the task. You know, I mean, this is really in on a speedy trial demand. So while there was a couple of different hiccups, you know, like down the road, but, you know, for the most part, I mean, both sides are prepared. The trial's moving pretty briskly and the decorum is there. You know, both sides are, you're not like for as snarky as it was leading up to this trial, you're having none of it.
Good.
During the trial. Okay. Yeah. It's all, both sides are acting professionally. They're taking their professional responsibility very, very seriously. Judge Gull, it is an objection heavy trial.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, there just have not been many objections. There's been a few, one interesting footnote that I did not going in to trial was that jury questions are allowed at trial in Indiana. And these jurors are very, very active with their questions. And I love it.
Okay.
I love jury questions. So many of the questions have been literally questions that I've written down in my notebook when I'm taking notes saying, why the fuck didn't they ask that?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So I love the concept of it, man. So that's kind of like the, you know, the 10,000 foot view from up above, just kind of how it's been in general. You know, openings, I thought McClelland was brief. Mm-hmm. You know, it was maybe 15, 17 minutes. He had a little tech issue with these. He's got a big 85 inch touchscreen monitor, like right in the courtroom, some new tech for him. It malfunctioned. They couldn't get whatever he was going to display during his opening, which is a rough way to start.
Yeah.
You know, as a defense attorney and just as a trial attorney in general, I really felt a lot of sympathy for him because, you know, you're in your head in that moment. Like,
well, and it just adds to the weirdness of everything. That one didn't happen to work, you know, like just like everything else with the defense that's been, you know, pooped on.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and you know, so he kind of waited around for 7 minutes and then just, you know what?
I'll just go.
Yeah. So he did it. Baldwin, in contrast, in stark contrast, went about an hour on his opening. Threw a lot of stuff out there. I'm sure you've been hearing rumblings about some of the interesting things that were said during that.
Yeah.
Whether or not he oversold their case is yet to be determined. Mm-hmm. He threw some bombshells out there, man. So we'll see how it plays out, which will kind of dovetail nicely into day four of the trial, which was today.
Yeah.
We had some eyewitnesses testify today, which were pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, let's get into some of that. You know, we had obviously day one, two, and three here. And some of the more standout testimony, what are some of those bombshells that were dropped? And then how is it being countered?
So I think that the biggest bombshell that was dropped for me personally, what I thought was a real game changer, was one of the eyewitnesses on the trail that day, a woman named Betsy Blair, which we did not know leading up to trial, which, like, you and I are always talking about, you have to wait to trial. Mm-hmm. It's like you can't speculate and wonder what the evidence is. And like, I never engage in the arguments online about shit that I don't know
yet
because we have to wait the trial. So
you don't know, you don't know.
You don't know. So what Baldwin said in the opening is that Betsy Blair, who's about a 50-year-old gal, goes out to the trail at that time in 2017, was out to the trail 3 to 4 times a week. That's where she got her walks in, her exercise in. She would do 3 like circuits or 3 loops, kind of like coming in, walking over the Freedom Bridge, making lefts and rights, ending at the Monon High Bridge, turning around, coming back. And she'd do that 3 times. So we come to find out, at least in opening, and it looks like it's going to be substantiated during actual testimony, because remember, opening statements are not evidence. So Baldwin says that she is going to come in and testify that when she passed the CPS parking lot, which is where the state believes that Richard Allen parked on the day in question, that at 2:15, when she drove by it leaving, that Richard Allen's car wasn't there anymore, which would mean that at 2:15, he was gone. Mm-hmm. Now, that's important because if you know anything about the case, or if you don't, the state's timeline is that the girls were kidnapped around 2:15. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that the murders took place sometime between 2:30 and 3:30. Mm-hmm. Because we know that the last activity on Liberty German's phone is at 2:13 PM.
Yeah.
That's verified. So she's theoretically a massive, massive witness. I mean, she's a witness that can really substantiate the fact that he was no longer at the park.
Yeah.
The trails.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's huge. There's been, so, and it was interesting today because they put her on, the state put her on. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they had 3 of the eyewitnesses that are on the trail. These are 3 of the witnesses that we read about in the probable cause affidavit when the arrest was made, and Betsy Blair and I think the last name of the first witness was Voorhees. Mm-hmm. And I want to say it's Riley Voorhees was the first girl to testify. She was 16 at the time. She was going to Delphi High School. She knew Kelsey. She knew Liberty.
Yeah.
She knew of Abby. And so she had picked up 2 of her sisters, one being 12. The other one, I didn't catch the age of. I don't know if they gave it. And then she picked up a friend of hers named Brianne. I want to say Willard. I don't have my notes. I got to double check it. So don't quote me on the names.
Yeah.
I think it's Willard, though. So the 4 of them are walking distance to the Freedom Bridge and the trails. Mm-hmm. So they leave. She claims, Rayleigh says that she leaves at 11:30, her home, her dad's house, gets over, I think stops by her mom's house, picks up her little sister. Mm-hmm. They then go to Brianne's, and then they stop and pick up her other sister. So she got 2 of her sisters and a friend. They then go over, walk through the Freedom, over the Freedom Trail, through the trails, and make the way down to the Monon High Bridge because they're going to take pictures. That's what they do. Yeah. She does. She goes. She walks about half the bridge out to the first platform, she being Rayleigh. And then she comes back, and then she takes a path down. She wants to go down to the water. So I think all of them end up going down to the water to take more pictures. So they end up coming back. And so 2 of the women that testified now, women 16 at the time that testified today, now say that, when they get out there, that they're both of their testimonies were similar in that they said that they were very close to reaching the Freedom Bridge when they see this guy. Mm-hmm. That they have very different descriptions of him. Rayleigh said that he was all wearing all black boots, black jeans, black coat, had a black hoodie on, and was wearing some kind of hat, and that he had a face covering that went up to about the bridge of his nose. Mm-hmm. So claimed that he was Caucasian, said that she had said hi because she was saying hi to everybody on the trails that day. She was just in good mood. This guy didn't wave, didn't say anything. She got a real bad vibe off this dude. She's like, this guy, I don't know what's going on mm-hmm. with him, but like he stuck in her head. She thought something was off about him. And, but again, like when she gets home and the story breaks, and then 2 days later when they release the still photo of Bridge Guy, you have to wonder if there's some confirmation bias there.
Yeah.
But, you know what I mean? It's like, it's so hard to tell with eyewitnesses. It's so hard to tell with 16-year-olds.
Your mind's always there. It's reconstructing it every single time. And if you start getting those biases in there, you'll actually, you can conjure up things that actually weren't there, but you'll believe they were.
100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So so that was essentially her direct on cross. I think that Jennifer Ogier did that cross, who was the female attorney on that team. And I think that she ended up getting out of her that she thought that the intruder was, or the perpetrator was, somewhere around 5'7 to 5'10. Mm-hmm. Now, Richard Allen's 5'4. So that was significant.
Yeah.
So then you get the second witness, which was Breanne Wilbur. And that's it, Wilbur, if I didn't say Wilbur first. So again, kind of the same thing. She kind of mimics a lot of what Briley had said in terms of, yeah, I got a, like, because she talks about how after they were off the bridge that the girls were talking about, Briley was talking about this guy, and you know that she got a bad vibe off of him.
Yeah.
So I think that's stuck in her head, because she didn't really recollect what he was wearing all that much. It was completely different than what her friend saw.
Yeah.
And just like she said, he had a lighter jacket, maybe blue, maybe black.
What a dramatic difference in.
Just very dramatic. Said that he did have a hood on, couldn't see his hair, whereas her friend had testified that she thought that he had dirty blonde hair that wasn't long per se, but was long enough so that she could see it through the hoodie. And she puts him, like, Baldwin crossed her and she had him at like 5, you know, and it's just, it's one of those things where, you know, it just goes to show you how difficult it is to rely on eyewitness testimony in a case like this. And then so you get Betsy Blair comes up and she testifies. And it was interesting. She says the same thing. She did the loops. She did two loops. She had to go to the bathroom. So she walked out of the trail, walked to her car, drove to the Delphi Library to use the restroom because she's civilized. People are like, oh, why didn't she just piss in the woods? I've walked the trail. This isn't like you're going into deep woods, like right off the trail.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of people walking. It's a very popular place for people to go and exercise. And it was quite lovely, you know, despite the kind of the overwhelming feeling that you get in there. But it's a very beautiful setting. So she does it and she drives back and then she does her third loop. She says that while she's doing her third loop, she gets down to the bridge. They have like kind of a big stop. Orange barricade to dissuade the kids from crawling, from walking over the bridge. So she looks, she sees a guy on a platform. She says he's youthful looking. She says that he looks to be somewhere in his 20s to 30s with a like fresh face. Completely different description than Richard Allen.
Yeah.
She says she didn't remember him wearing a hat. She didn't remember him having facial hair.
Sure.
And then at the point that Baldwin on cross-examination tries to bring up what I consider to be kind of a bombshell with the time that she drives back over there where the state is alleging that his car was parked during the time that he's allegedly killing the girls. And she says definitively, it's not there.
Yeah.
That the state objected because they didn't bring that up on direct. So you got the beyond the scope of direct examination objection, which many time judges will give the defense some leeway or the crossing party some leeway. Judge sustained it, which now means the defense is going to have to call her during their case in chief, which they will. Mm-hmm. So that didn't come out. And if I'm looking at it from a strategic point of view, I think that was a misplay by the state, because when they call her and and this is a very astute jury.
Yeah.
These people are paying rapt attention yesterday when we had the most devastating testimony and evidence into the case that will ever happen, aside from maybe when we get the autopsy. But we saw all the crime scene photos. Many of them were just like heart-crushing, devastating, brutal violence. You know, like seeing these two beautiful girls, you know, slain in that way is just, it was hard. It was a hard day in the courtroom. And that jury, man, like no one was breaking down.
Yeah.
They weren't showing any emotion. That's what you want. You want them there. You don't want them coming to a decision on this case in terms of innocence or guilt based on emotions. Mm-hmm. And they're thoughtfully, they're paying attention. I haven't seen one person drifting. I've seen every one of them paying attention to every single witness. I see them taking notes. And the questions, man, the questions are amazing because it lets you know just how much they're paying attention. Mm-hmm. And some of the questions are great. Great. So but to get back to my point,
yeah,
when this very astute jury realizes that it seems like the state was trying to hide the ball for some reason,
yeah,
with this weird objection in terms of like, why aren't you letting him ask the question about what time she left? Like, why are you doing that? And when it comes out that it's because Richard Allen's vehicle was no longer there,
it's gonna be a lot more dramatic than what that could have been. That could have been a gloss over. They wouldn't really have remembered it. When it becomes a point on the opposite side of this, closer to deliberation, it's going to make a bigger impact.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. So I thought it was a misplay on their part. And then, like there were a couple of witnesses that I thought the state handled in kind of an odd fashion. The last witness of the day was Steve Mullins, who was a investigator for the prosecutor's office, like, and has been for years. And there's a place where the feds were able to procure video, and it's called Hoover Harvest Store. Mm-hmm. And it's right on this 300 North County Road that is parallel to the trails. Runs parallel north of the trails. And so this particular, it doesn't have a wide view, but it catches all the vehicles that are driving eastbound away from the trails. It catches them on video. So the feds send him the video, and they also come to find out that the timestamp on those videos is 54 minutes fast. So they made the calculations, and so McClellan goes up with five different still photographs of five different, theoretically, it's only three vehicles, but five stills. They go through the when they Betsy Blair leaving and coming.
Yeah.
Okay. So when she goes east and west, and one of the times is the time that matters is they see her leave at 2:18. Mm-hmm. And that's when she said it. It literally substantiates her story.
Yeah.
But she had a Fitbit on anyway.
Okay.
Her Fitbit's like she's that tech witness that we need. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's going to be able to build timelines that help us figure this thing out.
Sure.
And she's very credible. Mm-hmm. Like she's a middle-aged gal who's got no dog in the hunt, reason to bullshit about anything. Her husband saw it on TV that the girls went missing, and he's the one who said, "Hey, weren't you out at the trail?"
Yeah.
Kind of like exactly what happened with Rick Allen. Exactly. You know, see it. Yeah. His wife's like, "Shouldn't you go tell him?" He's like, "Yeah, I'll go tell him I was out there."
What could possibly go wrong?
So he set some times up, and he's got Blair leaving at 2:18, man. And, I mean, it sets it up for a really interesting thing. We still have a long ways to go in the state's trial. Today, we saw the videos, my man.
Yeah.
We finally saw the elusive 43-second down the hill video.
What have we been missing in this? Was there anything to the extra 43 seconds? Or
no, it actually, I think it added a lot of context. It starts with Libby filming. Abby's probably about 15 yards.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond her on the tracks, and she's talking about, she's like walking on the side. They must be getting to the edge of the, they're getting to the end of the tracks because the tracks end And then the tracks are still going, but the bridge ends.
Yeah.
So I think Libby's standing like at the end of the bridge and Abby's still walking towards her. And then she's like, oh, she's filming down. She's like, there's some, you know, there's some gravel over here. And then I think Abby, you can see kind of Abby, it looks like she kind of like runs up to her. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, she's like, there's no path here, but we can go down here. You hear her say this. And then like, and when you see Abby, when I first saw the video, I could not see anybody behind her. Mm-hmm. Now, when they showed it a second time, I thought that I did see somebody probably like 30 to 40 yards back, who theoretically is bridge guy. Now, at the very end of the video is where they claim that they catch this audio. I didn't hear it the first time. When they played it the second time, I kind of heard down the hill, girl, something like that.
Yeah.
So, but this is the original video. This isn't the enhanced stuff. Mm-hmm. So it gives you some real scale and it creates a question in your mind if you're inquisitive as to how that guy that was so far behind her was able to get close enough to her to where they caught him on audio saying that.
Yeah. In that short of a period of time.
Yeah. On a railroad trestle that you cannot run across.
No, man. No.
These are missing dilapidated tile. Yeah. It
will
not
die. Yeah. Yeah.
People will die. Yeah. So was interesting, man. We then heard the witness who, brought on the enhancement. So he was a forensic, digital forensic guy. Didn't really have much of a background in it. He was kind of like, so how did you do it? Well, I resized it and then I tweaked it and then I turned it and then I brightened it up.
The cell phone witness in the Murdaugh trial where it's like, well, I tossed the phone across the room.
I kind of spun it in the air to see if it would. a lot like that guy.
Oh, great.
And so like my favorite line that he said, and it was on direct. He says, well, you know, if the image is blurry, it's just blurry. there's no fixing a blurry image. Like there's that kind of technology that we all see on CSI and all the shows that we watch where they're like, hey, clear that plate up for me. And then it's crystal clear. That's not real.
No.
That technology does not exist in the world. Not yet. I'm sure AI will get us there.
We'll get there.
As of now, it doesn't. Doesn't exist. So
I want to ask you one more thing about it before we wrap up. I've been hearing reports of Richard Allen. What did you observe of Richard Allen in the courtroom today, and especially when they were showing the images the other day? I'm hearing various reports of kind of a disturbed man rocking back and forth and such. What did you witness?
I'm not getting any of that.
No?
No. He's engaging. I'm not seeing any of this. I heard somebody saying they thought he was praying. I see him turn around and wink at his wife.
Yeah.
I see him like he wasn't afraid to look at the pictures. Sure. He didn't have his head down.
You think there's,
I'm getting a very different vibe and it's like I'm completely objective about it.
Yeah.
I don't know if people are trying to make it dramatic
or there's too much of a microscope on him and any move he makes is going to be over dramatized intentionally or not. You know, I don't know,
I'll tell you, I've got an excellent seat.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm in the second row on defense side over there. Cause the family is on, the prosecutor's side, they have a less than stellar view in terms of being able to see the large monitor, which is over on the left side. If you're facing the bench on the left side of the courtroom, and it's huge. If you're past midway on that side, you're not seeing anything.
Okay.
Like you can't see any of that. So in terms of what I'm trying to say is unless Alan's turning around and looking like towards the gallery, no one's seeing what his reactions are. They're full of shit.
Okay.
Because we're all behind him.
Yeah.
There's no, you know what I'm saying? And
sure.
And we're pretty close to the bar of the court, you know, where that separates the lawyers and the tables from the gallery.
Interesting.
So it's not like we're 50 feet away. Like, I mean, we're close, but you're not going you can see the back of his head.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see him he's not doing any of the things that he was doing before. But I'm not watching him every second.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
So maybe somebody saw something. Mm-hmm. But the times that I'm observing him, I haven't seen him doing anything weird. I haven't the jurors haven't been staring at him. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm not like, and I know that people like to look at the defendant and try to read his body language all, and not just in this case, but every case. And, you know, from what I've seen, he's always got his little readers on his, on top of his head like this. Mm-hmm. Every day he comes in, he's been well-dressed, shirt tucked in. He's always got a nice shirt, you know, some decent slacks on. Like I said, he's been very engaged with his lawyers. He's just, it's conversational. Like I, like for the 2 years that I've covered this case, boots on the ground, I never saw him talking to his lawyers. Mm-hmm. Like, and since trial has begun,
it seems like a normal, like you wouldn't have any, like a
dude, that's the perfect way to describe it. Like just like, if you or I were like trying to discuss things about the case, things that are being said, he's just, he's fully engaged. Yeah. Okay. So, which, like I said, in the terms of wanting a fair trial, that's what you want to see.
Sure. Sure. That's good to hear. Contrary to some of those other things we've been hearing, that you've seen that. Yep. That's good. That's good. All right. Obviously, there's more to come. Bob Mata, defense attorney.
More to come, baby.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
So they said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Running a business is hard work. Building your website shouldn't be. With Wix, you can express your ideas, give direction, then leave the heavy lifting to AI, from site creation to branded content and images. Have fun with the details. Customize what you want, the way you want, and manage your whole business from a centralized dashboard with expert AI tools. Build, scale, and enjoy the incredible results. You can do it all yourself on Wix.
Lowe's knows you take pride in every project. So take on what's next today with a free select Craftsman hedge trimmer or leaf blower when you buy a 20-volt push mower. That's a $119 value on reliable, high-performance Craftsman tools you trust. For the power to do it all, build, repair, restore, maintain, go with Craftsman. Available at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 5/21. While supplies last. Selection varies by location. Memorial Day deals are here at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances, including Samsung. Plus, save an extra $50 on every $500 you spend on select major appliances, $396 or more. Like the Samsung Bespoke French Door Refrigerator, featuring Beverage Center and Dual Ice Maker. Shop at Lowe's today. We help. You save. Valid 5/15 through 6/18. Selection varies by location. Total savings varies based on purchase amount. See Lowe's.com for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.